Anybody got any questions? Anybody read them? Well, that's very broad then, isn't it? Some people outside this group do read them. And with your approval, what I usually do is to rewrite history a bit, not just to record the conversation we actually had, but to try and fill out what it all means, so that it does make a record of the kind of things we're talking about for other people. And there are folk from the ASRG who pick it up, and from other mailing lists and all sorts of funny places. I always put this one in. I would be delighted to have somebody volunteering to co-chair this group. The qualifications are that you want to do it, so that excludes almost everybody. Anybody who wants to do it instead of me is equally welcome. I didn't get here, well, I am actually dead keen on this stuff, but I got here because everybody else stepped backwards at a certain point. And if somebody believes they can do it better and would like to, and can put more time and effort into it than I sometimes can, I'm not going to make a fuss about that. But I think, more realistically, if anybody would like to co-chair it, that would be really valuable. You don't have to do that now, just any time. Okay, now, the large-scale item here is this update on what's going on in the world, and actually this takes up most of our time, because we try to reflect what the spammers are doing and what the anti-spammers are doing. There are some other things coming up there, but actually it's Sabri's turn. Sabri Berisha has volunteered to do the first serious tutorial we've had for some time on DNSBLs, that's DNS black or block lists, which he'll explain to you in great detail, taking about 10 minutes, 15? 15 minutes, okay? The clock starts. We'll just talk quietly among ourselves for a moment while that. Slight pause. I think we'll probably move on to look at what the list discussion was. I'll just go through this until somebody thinks you might be back on the air and catch up on you. The only thing I've seen on that I think is of any interest on the anti-spam working group list is some discussion of the abuse C entry and who is, which I was proposing to talk about not in view of that discussion, but there's been more discussion of it in the database working group list. But that's all right, Wilfrey. So that actually is a bit of a null entry, really. And the next one there is developments in bulk mail. I think that won't take long either. Are you ready? Okay, in that case we'll... apologies to those who are listening remotely. We're having the usual unimaginable technical difficulties. One laptop works fine and the other one doesn't work at all. And there's not much you can try, is there, offline? Ooh. Windows. Oh, sorry. How much have you got on there? Okay. If it doesn't come up in at this time round, you can have to scurry away and see what happens somewhere else. While we're watching Mr. Gates's fine displays, I could just start outlining what I think is going to be an interesting bit of discussion. This is the stuff in connection with the database working group about the recording of an abuse contact so that the right people get to use it through the Whois service. There are all sorts of issues that have come up. The database working group have installed a thing called the IRT object, which formally does this, but actually it's not quite what most people wanted. And there's an issue about whether we pursue that and get people to deploy it, or whether we have to do something else as well, or instead, or for the time being, something of that nature. Are people familiar with the, I know you enjoy watching Unix boot sequence, but are people familiar with the issue here? One is, and that means presumably that 29 or 39 are not. Wilfried, do you feel like just saying what this is all about, or do you want me to do it? Yeah, there is indeed a moving microphone, which I haven't tested.
Yeah, it comes on.
Okay. You have to speak loudly for Malin.
I have to speak. Okay, yeah. Sort of to provide a little bit of framework here, I'd like to repeat a couple of sentences in one of my messages on the database working group mailing list, and that's actually an outline of the original goal or the original mandate for the database. And the primary purpose of having the RIPE database in the first place is to keep track of the IP address space distribution for those parts of the IP address space which is distributed and administered by way of the RIPE NCC and the local registries. And the set of data which is in the database and which makes up the IP address registry is actually an authoritative part. So the RIPE NCC and the RIPE community together has a shared responsibility to keep the data complete and correct and up to date as good as possible in the real world. The second function here is the RIPE region routing registry. That's the IP routing registry, and that's actually a collection of data which can be maintained and can be used by everyone and her dog trying to either debug routing problems or configure parts of their routing engines, routing machinery, depending on the entries in the routing registry. So if two ISPs are having a routing relationship amongst each other, and both of them actually document in the routing registry what the routing policy should look like between them, and both of them agree, then they can both query the data from the database, run the answers through some sort of scripts or programs, and generate router configuration scripts, or at least snippets for those configurations from the database, and after probably double-checking the sanity of that, put it into the boxes. And for that collection of data, the RIPE NCC is not responsible, neither for the correctness nor for the completeness. And sort of this is the basic, or this was the basic mandate why we built the database and why we maintained the code and added capabilities. As soon as you have these types of registries, what you also want to have is contact information for the holders of the resource or for the maintainers of data in the database. And the original model was that each and every object in the database has an administrative contact and a technical contact. And the original model there was that if you have sort of an administrative issue with the holder of an IP address space, an IP address block, like you think that it doesn't belong to that entity and it is your IP address space, which they have been grabbing and configuring on their boxes, then you should get in touch with them on the administrative level, like don't use resources which have been allocated to someone else. If you have a technical problem, like everything has been working and Sunday at around midnight, you can no longer ping or traceroute or get access to the other party's web server, and you want to find out what's wrong, then you would probably want to talk to the technical contact. And that was the original model. That's the reason why there is an admin C and a tech C in all of those objects, and those links point to person or role objects. And then with a person, you describe an individual with his postal address, with his email address, and with a couple of other things. If you point to a role, then you can actually describe something like a network operations center or a team of people taking care of technical aspects in the network.
Okay,
can I just
interrupt. Well, you're probably going to ask this. You can see where Bill is coming from. He's describing some contact information that is in the database and just setting it in context and how authoritative it is and the sort of purposes for which people wanted it and in fact have come to use it. And you're now going on to say
I'm going on to say that in addition to just providing the contact data, we also added the feature to keep track of who made changes to the database. And that's actually the changed line in all of those database objects. And this is just an indication who submitted an update and at what point in time. This entry there does not have anything to do with the responsibility or the contact information for an operational network or for the holder of an IP address space. However, and this is I'm coming back to the problem here. However, at some point in time it happened so that the uninitiated users, for whatever reason, started to simply look for any type or any sort or any shape of IP address in the database. Email address. And if you look at the answer from a WHOIS server, and the answer happens to be long because there is many attributes in this object and you have got a small window on the screen, the only piece that remains on the screen is the last part of the object. That's the bottom of the object. And usually at the bottom of the object, what you see is the change record of the object. So in many of those situations, actually the real contact information was already wrapped off the screen, and the only thing that you're seeing is the data maintenance part of this game. And then people started to write scripts and started to look at email addresses, and they did not have, either they did not want to understand or they did not have the background to understand at what particular pieces in these answers they should look. So they started to use each and every email address they could find. And that's, from my point of view, that's sort of one of the basic issues here that should be discussed. Like, what is the default answer that you get as an everyday user of the database if you do a Whois query. That's one of the very basic answers. Very basic questions. The other thing is, just to round it out, and then it's a couple of sentences. And then we started to build machinery into the database to support particular applications or particular things to take care of. That was using digital signatures to protect the update path. That was things like maintainer objects, which have been put there to help in maintaining lots and lots and lots of different objects which should be treated the same on an administrative level. And the last thing in this chain of developments was the IRT object, the incident response team object, that it was built and crafted to help a particular set of problems. That's actually sort of to support the incident response teams in their interaction with each other and with the user community. That's the background here from my point of view. And the most recent proposal that was distributed is to sort of just add another entry into all of those objects with the attribute name abuse C. And that's where we stand with the discussion right now. And that's actually where I want to give it back to you.
That's right. I was going to ask for that back. I think that's right. That is set in the scene, really. The question for the database group is, do we go ahead with the abuse C object or attribute? And people will have their own views, and if you'd like to turn that over, because we will come back to that, and I think it's important that we've had some input from Bill Griffiths at this stage. Are there any immediate questions on that? Otherwise, I'd like to try and get back on my original schedule. Okay, it's going to come up again, and I hope Wilfried will feel he doesn't have to say the same things again. I'm sure there'll be some different things you need to say. Okay, back on the air then. For Sabri, is that all right? Something works now? Good, okay. All up to you. Important lesson.
Kikoo.
Ah, there goes.
I will.
Very well, folks at home and people here. My name is Sabri Birisha. I work for BIT, which is a local internet provider here in the Netherlands, near the German border. I am a frequent visitor of this working group, and last time I visited this, there was a question if anybody would like to give some tutorials. Well, I will. I use DNS blacklist. I maintain a DNS blacklist, so I thought, well, let's give a short tutorial on how to use and to operate a DNS blacklist. So that's what it's going to be about. If there's any question, please ask. I'm going to do some technical stuff. If you don't understand it, just say so, because it's better to ask it here than to go home and to use Google and don't understand it anymore. So just ask. This is our to-do list for today. First, a very short introduction. Next, we have blacklisting versus whitelisting. I'm going to explain how a DNS blacklist works. Then, we are going to create one. After that, I will explain how to use a DNS blacklist on SendMail. After that, a short introduction on how to use it on QMail. Next, some URLs on the topic. And after that, you can bash me. Very short, DNSBL stands of course for a DNS blacklist, which basically means that you have a blacklist which is maintained through the DNS system, which you can query through the DNS system, and which you can use to blacklist other people. We used to call it RBL, which stands for real-time blackholing list, but that is a name which is currently registered to our friends at MAPS. So we don't use it anymore, and we use DNSBL. Everybody who operates a DNS server can maintain his own blacklist, or whitelist, or whatever you want to call it. It's basically very simple, as we are going to see in a few minutes. We used to have, in the old days, a few years ago, we had two very large blacklists, orbs and maps. Orbs was a blacklist which had a lot of open relays in it, so if you would secure your server with this blacklist, then you would have less problems with open relays mailing spam for you through those relays. And of course maps, which has a number of other blacklists, including a dial-up list and stuff. But unfortunately maps has gone commercial and they want some money for their servers, so I don't use it. When you use a blacklist which is being maintained by somebody else, you are basically saying that the third party can decide who sends mail to you and who can't. So, before you blacklist anything, do your whitelisting. Whitelist your own IP space, your own domain names, if you use any blacklist. It's very important. It has happened to me sometimes that my own users were on blacklist because they had an open relay or an open proxy and they couldn't send mail even with it within our own ISP. And that's not nice, of course, as you can understand. So it's very important to do that. Like I said, a DNS blacklist is worked through the DNS system. Very simple. You make a record for a certain IP address. You reverse the address, as in this example, 213.136.0.66 will be listed as 66.0.136.213.whatever blacklist you are maintaining. And then if it resolves, then it's blacklisted or whitelisted as you wish. Domain records are not reversed, so if you want to blacklist bat.nl, you will just type bat.nl.something. The A record usually returns 127.0.0.2, but not always. There are some blacklists which use other numbers, so you can have a certain identification on the number. So if, for instance, I operate a DNS blacklist with just mapping from an IP to a country. So country A has .2, country B has .3, country C has .4, and go on and go on. You always have to add a TXT record. Just whatever you want to list, say that, just say it. Because there is some software who explicitly look for TXT records. So simply having 127.0.0.2 doesn't always work. Now, we're going to create one. I'm not sure if I can type and talk at the same time, so you'll just have to look a bit. How am I going to get out of this? I have a bind 8 on this laptop, so I'm going to go into the directory, and I have created a zone file for it, which is in fact very simple. As you can see, nothing special, just your ordinary bind configuration. Is this readable for everybody? Nearly. Well, I'm going to specify that. This says the zone is write.dnsbl.cluecentral.net. It's a master, and it has a file name somewhere. So the name of my blacklist here is write.dnsbl.cluecentral.net. Again, quite ordinary. We have a start of authority with the normal stuff. The name of that laptop currently is 10DNS1. It has an actual A record, so anybody here who has a laptop can try to resolve it. It works. I have two examples in it. These are usually used for the test entries. So if you maintain your own blacklist, always add 127.0.0.2 and example.com. So anybody who wants to test if your blacklist is alive, they can do it. Now, does anybody here have an IP address he or she wants to have blacklisted? Nobody? Okay. Then I will try one. Okay, very well. I forgot myself. I maintain my blacklist using script, so I started once. Then I click make it. Should resolve. Very well. I have now blacklisted the IP from my own co-located machine. Does anybody understand what I just did? If you don't understand, just say so. Very well. Back to the slides then. Right now I'm gonna use send mail to configure my blacklist. It's basically very simple. I have a pre-compiled sendmail binary, but I'm gonna take you all to the source. It's not that hard. Just look and share. In the source directory from sendmail, we have a directory called cf/cf. It has some pre-made M4 files in which the only thing you have to add is this line. You turn on the feature DNS blacklist. You tell sendmail which list you wish to use, which is in fact wrongly typed here. And next, you can add a line which is told to the remote MTA when your mail server sends a 550. That's all you have to do. Then you just have to make your configuration file and restart SendMail. And if all goes well, then it should be able to work, which we are going to test right now. They're a bit different on this system. We have blacklisted this IP address. So next I'm going to SSH to that box and try to send mail from it. We'll see what happens. It seems that we have a firewall here. Well, we don't. Anybody here with a laptop? Can you try to reach port 25 on that IP? It's 193.0.8.52. You are going to be blacklisted. What's your IP? Has cast a negative result. it appears as if to write DNS server has cast a negative result. Let's see how we can work this out. This one's not. It's firewall. It wasn't this afternoon when I tried it. Well, what should have happened was that you got a nice big 550, which said, have a nice day, you're not going to send us to this. No, you say hello, then you say mail from, they say RCPT2, then it says bye bye. Yeah. I can demonstrate it on another box, if you have a moment.
Suggestions, which nobody's come up with the fix for what Sabri was trying to do. Any questions about this one? How many people use these DNS blacklists? Okay, so a fair proportion who clearly do know something about what's going on. Does anybody actually operate one internally or for public use? Okay. Because that's another interesting question, you know. So we did start off saying that one of the virtues of doing your own is that you can then apply your own policy, and there's something to be said for that. On the other hand, you have to think what the issues are for people who are making their data available fairly widely, even if it's commercially. And the one of the real issues there is what the criteria are for listing an IP address. And he mentioned ORBS, which is no more. Now, I think the reason why ORBS is no more is not related to this, but it was actually true that things got into the ORBS database just because the guy who did it didn't like the color of the numbers or something like that. There would be very arbitrary reasons why addresses got in there. And it's very hard to get them out under those circumstances. But it did, you know, he was very fast moving and stuff got in there very promptly. The other extreme is the maps approach, quite apart from its commercial aspect, where they are very cautious and they have, you know, very rigid criteria for allowing things into the list. So not much gets listed. And it doesn't actually stop a lot of spam. It does upset the people who get listed because there's a certain stigma to it still. And there are others that are somewhere in between. I don't think I'm going to successfully provide a catalogue of what all the known RBLs are. It's just possible that there'll be a URL for there are some lists of lists. One of the more spectacular ones is the SBL, Spamhaus block list. Spamhaus is an organisation run by a gentleman on a houseboat in London who's actually been very effective in tracing who the real people are at the beginning of the spammer's route, as to say the people who are making money out of it and are actually the folk you're up against. So when he says that there are 80 of them and two-thirds of them live in Florida or something like that, he's almost certainly right, and that's very valuable information, and some of that is incorporated in the SBL, Spammer's Block. That's another reputable one which is still openly available. There are loads more, and that I think is reputable. I didn't have any hesitation in telling people to use that. There are others where you take your chance. You know, if you read what they say and it looks all right to you, and you're prepared to inflict that on your customers, then you can do that. What you do if someone don't like it, or if some of the people listed don't like it, is an interesting question. Any other sort of thoughts about this? Is this a here's a question on which you might have thoughts. Is this a way out of our present problems with spam? That's one question. whether it is or not, is it actually something that's here to stay? People got any views on it? In 5 years' time, shall we still be talking about DNS blacklists? The question was, what sort of proportion of the internet should be allowed to send mail to just any old place? Opinions will differ. I don't want to say mine first. Right. Yeah. Well, one of the interesting ways that this stuff has turned out to be used, the subject mentioned the MAPS dial-up list, or dial-up user list or something. Now this goes back to times when the people who should not be sending mail directly were those at the end of dial-up services. So that's how the name came there. But there are indeed a lot of addresses, a lot of large blocks of addresses whose provider doesn't really want them to send stuff out directly. And so you could actually ask for those to be listed. And that would be a different way of operating, of using the thing. Yeah. Inbound, right? We must, yeah, okay. That's an issue. And actually, that's one of the things that we mentioned yesterday at the EOF, and I will come back to, particularly blocking outbound. I mean, blocking inbound is up to you and your customers what you want. Blocking outbound is a bit more emotive, and there's some stuff about it later on. Are you ready to go? Okay, more from Sabri. Sorry, it's a bit to and fro, but let's, you know, that we haven't got any children or animals, but we have got computers.
Unfortunately, computers don't always cooperate. What I just did, some of you may have watched me typing. I've set up this DNS blacklist on my co-located box. And what I'm going to do right now is I have blacklisted the IP of that laptop. And from the laptop, I'm going to try to send mail through that box, the DOS, which is a box co-located in our main co-location center in Ada. Let's see what happens.
We have this out here using the world's most reliable mail user agent, it's called Telnet.
And what does it do? It gives me 553 in this one.
Hooray, well done.
Yay. Fortunately, this will only blacklist this IP address because all my incoming mail is going through that mail server. So I am quite happy that this works. What I basically did right now is I also took my next slide, which was configuring a DNS blacklist for QMail, which I will explain right now.
Just before Sabri talks about QMail, how many people don't know what QMail is? In that case, I don't have to say what QMail is.
And for the people who are afraid to list their hands, QMail is just another SMTP server, such as SendMail or XM or whatever you use. QMail is written by Daniel J. Bernstein, and it's quite trivial, so I don't like to use it. This is my laptop. And this here is my remote box. And as some of you probably know, you usually run QML under TCP server, preferably under daemon tools. As you will notice, there is a small difference in how you are started. This is how you usually use QML. You invoke TCP server, it listens on port 25. When it gets an incoming connection, it will run our friend QML-SMTPD. If you wish to use a DNS blacklist, all you have to do is add in another binary, which is being done here. This one, RBL-SMTPD. The B stands for blacklist, if I'm correct, and the R stands for the list which you want to use. You can add as many dash R's as you wish. I only did my own one here. So what basically just happened, I telnet to port 25. RBL-SMTPD was started up. It checked where was the connection coming from. It saw that that IP address was listed in this blacklist, and it then got into a small loop which just took the SMTP commands and set 553 whatever TXT record there is. If an IP address is not listed, then standard in and standard out are redirected to this binary, QML-SMTPD, which is the normal binary which is being used to operate QML. So everybody understand that? So basically, all you do is put in a man in the middle, or a binary in the middle, which does the checking, and if you are okay, then you will be redirected to the original binary, and if you are not okay, then you will be stuck in there forever. Whatever command you send, you will never be able to send any mail. Because that's how it works on QML. It works quite well. There's only one very big disadvantage from Boatspace. I did it right now. That especially for QML, whatever you do, if an IP address is blacklisted, no mail will be accepted. Not at all. Sounds fair, you think, but that's not always, because as you all know, we are RFC obligated to get some addresses to work, like Postmaster or Abuse. They won't work as well. So if you use this, you are violating some RFCs. It's personally, I couldn't care less.
Some people managed to fix that, but I can't remember how. I mean, clearly you've got to go, the virtue of this, well, one virtue of it, is that it cuts out unwanted connections at a very early stage in the SMTP conversation. But, you know, in order to let Postmaster through, you cannot abort it at that stage. You've got to at least listen for them to tell you it's Postmaster they wanted to write to. And at that stage, it's rather harder to just drop the thing. It's not impossible.
Which for some people, we're using QML here. Are there any people using it? You may have noticed this one. This QML binary is a bit different from the one you get when you download it. This is patched by myself. It uses another client on this IP address listening on this port, which is actually registered at IANA, which does all the checking per user and per domain, so I can simply whitelist all incoming mail for Abuse or Postmaster or whatever, which I might talk on some future work group meetings. But for now, this will do, I hope. So anybody have any questions?
Okay, I've got a question. Send mail, yes. Xing, yes. Qmail, yes. What's the missing one?
Postfix, Xing.
Actually, Exchange was the one I was thinking of.
Exchange.
There are several of those out there, and you can't do this with it. Say again. It's a mail program. It's
I don't know of any way to use blacklist on Exchange. So if anybody knows, please step forward.
Well,
here's a laptop.
The two standard ways are, you put another box in front that's got a real mail program. And you know, if you, this is not desperately expensive on a fairly small outfit. There are also some products that coexist with Exchange. I used to know the name of one that was supposed to do this, but I never heard of anybody using it. I just think people don't seem to do it. So it's an interesting question. So unfortunately, we're going to mention Comrade Gates a little later on, where he can fix a whole lot of problems, but he can't fix this one, I'm afraid. So. Anything else? Our eternal gratitude. Thank you. There will be a short pause while we work out which is the wireless button. Right, thank you for that. Now, where were we? So we got down the top of that bit, and because of the little shambles we had to start with, we've actually anticipated some of this stuff. I would like to move on because it's 5 o'clock, and you know we really ought to try and finish on time. So that one we will come back to, and Wilfred has kindly given us a bit of an introduction to it. The only things that I could think of that are new in spam at the moment, they're not brand new, of course. The first one, there seemed to me to have been a lot more of the attempts, the sort of phishing attempts, to try and get people to expose the details of their banking accounts and things like that. So almost every bank or finance house seems to have had it, or and PayPal as well, seems to have had people putting out fake pages using bulk mail to try and get account details. The technology for distributing this stuff is not very exciting, but the fact that they've got this application for it. The other thing is that the bots and Trojans, the male zombies, installed by various means, seem to be here to stay. There's a comment. Is it one that everybody should hear? You should stand on the microphone. In the UK, some opinions differ. You sometimes get on better with ICSIS, the people who control the premium rate and regulate premium rate industry. So, I think you're right. Yes, you're right. So that route, which used to work quite, occasionally. Yeah, that's right. Oh, I'm sorry. Right. The issue. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'll do that. The issue was about fraudulent mails, where the sort of pickup of the fraud is a telephone number, and where it will be it's a pretty convincing case to say whoever pays for this telephone number is at the root of this business, and actually you can't get telcos to do anything much with that number, and you can't get anybody else to do very much either.
The number portability is very much.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you may not be able to work it out, and there's nobody, nobody. It may be different in other countries. Have other countries got slightly different experience of that? So it's an interesting prospect. And in everyday terms, you think that there's a phone number, surely you know who it is, but they actually feel probably fairly safe. Okay, and in the UK you can get very similar things. So, yeah, getting... Oh, they did that. I'm sorry, I don't keep up with this stuff. Yes, that's right. I'm sorry, I do remember that coming up in the context of paedophile activity, which is another growth. It's not a growth industry in the context of spam, not yet anyway. But it's the one thing that you can get anybody in the UK, any official body, to jump up and down again about. If you can say this phone number was used for, or this mail address, or something like that, they'll do it. But nothing else. And I'm sure it's quite different than every other. Okay, so I asked whether there's any real difference. This is not very dramatic stuff, I think. Anything else that people notice? Are they doing things differently? Is there more? Is there less? Stupid question. Okay. The good guys, some of whom are listed there. ASRG I'll do in a minute, unless somebody else wants to do it. We'll still do it in a minute. Microsoft has a bit more to say, and... AOL and one or two other people will come back to. Something has happened to SpamCop. Interestingly, just to sort of pick up the tiny bits of the abuse C discussion, I explained to Julian Haight what the IRT object was about, and he said, "Oh, that's very good. I could code that into SpamCop, but SpamCop could actually plow through the right WHOIS database looking for the right thing." He wasn't impressed that I explained to him there weren't actually very many there at the moment, and so he hasn't done it, and his world has moved on a bit anyway. So that there are some contacts there. So there's something happened to SpamCop's sort of business or way of working, and I've forgotten exactly what it is. Can we remember? Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I think he's sort of clawed back from doing some of the more exciting things that he used to do. But this is mostly the SpamCop blacklists. You will still see plenty of misdirected SpamCop reports, and that's partly an issue of misdirection, which is the abuse C issue, and it's partly because the stuff makes it too easy to report things without people thinking whether they're reporting to the right place. So there's a lot of over-reporting goes on in SpamCop, and with one or two other things, SpamKiller, with one or two other reporting engines, which we just broadcast stuff. Anything else about SpamCop? Habeas. How many people know what Habeas is? Oh, a tiny smattering. Okay, in that case I will stick my neck out and say a few words about it. They are a company in the US, I think in California, who wrote a poem, a haiku, no less, possibly more than one, I don't know, and it is copyright. And if you pay them money, you can stick it in the message header of any messages you send. And because you've made certain promises when you pay them for it, your mail is okay. And anybody who finds their haiku in your message header is entitled, if you like, to accept that you've jumped through Habeas's hoops. And that mail is probably acceptable. You probably don't have to turn it down. Now, this only works because they were prepared to be vicious in defending the copyright they were. So if a spammer tries to do the same thing, and if they can find out who it is, then they will get them using existing legislation on copyright issues. Now, they've had a go at some people, and I think they certainly frightened quite a lot of people. And I think they've had a go at some people as well. But the chief executive has moved off. Things are not happy in Habeas. I think they've been bought by Iron Hawk, is it? Somebody? Well, there you are. If you didn't know about them beforehand, you won't know about them now. It's not clear whether they're going to be declared. It was an ingenious idea. Seems to me a mistake to use legislation or arrangements that were made for one purpose, whatever you think of the rights and wrongs of copyright, to try and fix a different problem. But it was ingenious, and you know, they did put lawyer money behind it, and I think they had some success. Okay, but I think probably we shan't hear much more about that. Microsoft, I've just got a separate page about. AOL were dead keen to put on to deal with some things called domain keys, which I never quite understood. But I think it was a cryptographic thing associated with the domain from which messages were supposed to come. Does anybody know better than that? It was what they said they were going to do, but I'm not sure they've actually done it. The thing they have done is one of the ASRG's things. I'm not quite sure what I put down next. Called SPF. And you know that one next. Alright, in that case. Right, I'll come back to AOL SPF in just a minute. Microsoft are desperately exciting in this. I've picked out from some of the stuff they presented recently some of the ways they believe they're going to fix spam, as you know, in 2 years. They made a famous public statement about it. So, you know, we can all go on holiday in 2 years now. And we'll see. I'm sorry, I have paraphrased. I can't find this list anywhere in any one place at the moment. I do remember that at one point Microsoft people were going around with a presentation that seemed to come from fairly high up, and they were talking about five pillars of their anti-spam strategy. The number seems to go up and down a bit. I think I've got seven here, but it was only three that were published last week. They think they can fix it for their customers because they will have a commercial. They talk about MSN, they talk about Hotmail. You soon have to pay for Hotmail, and what you will get will be a service largely free of unwanted incoming mail. No, I'll rephrase that. It will be largely free of mail that they didn't want you to get, and that's not quite the same thing. And those of you who play with Hotmail, I mean, I have a Hotmail account, which is there purely so I can delete it and count the messages I deleted. And it used to be 50 a day, and it's now down to 3 or 10, something like that. So they're obviously doing quite well in throwing stuff away. And bear in mind, every message that comes from my Hotmail account is a failure. It's a spam trap in that sense. That's quite good progress, and people should be prepared to pay for that if they end up online. So that's one of the ways they can do it. Filtering, of course, is part of that. They're quite keen that you should filter things, and you will have picked that up in Bill Gates' recent statement. They do some source blocking. Has anybody had reports from them that we have blocked your address because? Oh, we get those on behalf of our customer. Don't see why everybody else doesn't. We've blacklisted your mail address because we thought some funny stuff was coming from it. And they never tell you what it is. It's dead difficult to do anything with that information, but you try. Recipient whitelist, this is down at the Hotmail level where you can have a list of your friends, and if anybody pretends to be your friend, then they can send mail to you. They're very keen on that. They think it's actually a big part of the strategy. Challenge response, again, he was talking about that recently, where a mail message comes in and it gets held somewhere, presumably in a paying Microsoft service, while the server just sends back a query, sends back, he described it as a simple puzzle, what letter is this, where actually all you get is a GIF with the letter Z in it, something like that. Something that a human is supposed to be able to fix, but not a program. And there are other kinds of challenge response for that one. You may think the next one is a bit like that. They're also suggesting that by making senders pay under some circumstances, to have their messages delivered, that will deter them from sending millions. Well, maybe. But the interesting thing is that they reckon they can get the payment done at the recipient end rather than the sender end. So rather than you sending stuff, you're paying stamps and then sending the stuff off, you sort of wave this thing at the recipient, who then says, "Oh, I'll take that for 25 cents or whatever it is." And it's all a bit complicated. I haven't seen any of that. It's not quite the same as the Camran and Hashcash arrangements which the ASRD and some of the people have seen. And they're also pretty big on litigation, which is not quite the same as legislation, which I almost wrote there. But they are actually keen on the CAN-SPAN legislation, but not, I think, in quite the same sense as that. So, and of course, one of the things that Microsoft have got is lawyers. So if they choose to take somebody out, they probably can. It's not clear to me that when they do that, they'll be taking out somebody I wanted to. An interesting question. Does anybody know better than me on any of this stuff? Would they like to say anything? Oh, yes. I'm glad somebody knows better.
I read a whole bunch of things about the sender and players, which is what you said about the challenges once that they're going to do with these puzzles. I heard it was a CPU puzzle that said that they challenge the MTA.
Okay, that's a fair comment. I think you have to get into the mindset a bit. Litigation is something that nobody else can do in quite the same way. Now, that is something distinctive to perhaps a handful of organisations of their size, their international coverage. Okay. The other thing is that you have to think that they're actually only protecting their own people. They're not here to make the world a better place. They're here to make the world a better place for Microsoft customers. And you know, at one level, you cannot complain about that, but to go around pretending they're going to save the world when they're actually only going to save that portion of the world that pays money to Microsoft, it is perhaps a little bit misleading. I withdraw that scurrilous suggestion. Sorry, is there anything else to say about Microsoft? They are, you know, they're big players, not the only big players, but what they do will make a difference, and it's not clear to me that it'll do things good that are good for me or for my customers. I just don't know. Right, this just slips in. There's not much to say, I think, about most of this. In Europe, the directive on doing the right thing, it gets through more and more countries. I've just named three there for reasons I can't remember at the moment. Denmark have actually managed to fine somebody quite substantially, I think one or two people. In the UK, we actually got our legislation in place only a few weeks late. I know why I put that, because somebody's commented that in Sweden, and it's also true in the UK, and this does come pretty much from the EU directives. It's only people in their personal individual capacity who get any protection here. In the first instance, businesses don't get it. So business mail addresses, or your personal addresses at a business, in a business domain, it's all a little bit ill-defined, but there's a whole area that could have been protected and isn't in that way. Anybody else want to say anything about European Commission? Okay. Are there any other bits of regional, national stuff in Europe that I should know about? Okay. Fine. Okay. No, that's fine. Well, you know, it's coming through at different speeds, and the Commission is very upset about that. But, you know, a few months. We'll see. Okay, in the States, they've had this wonderful can-span thing. Now, I think this is the first federal legislation they've had. At least the first one's got through. I may be wrong in detail on that. And it's a shambles. The only people you hear saying it's good are Microsoft, interestingly, and all the bulk mailers, who say that because these things we didn't much want to do are illegal, and it doesn't say anything about the rest, the others are okay, we can do those. So anybody who considers themselves to be reputable and jumps through a small number of hoops is pretty much enabled by this thing, or so they feel. So it's not clear what interests cause this thing to be put up, or what it's really going to achieve. But there could still be something. It's a bit like the EU directives. It may set a tone and say that these things are globally not acceptable. And how you work it out in detail, you know, you must sort out. But it sets a direction. But I'm not sure that it sets such a good direction as the EU directive. Is anybody here in any sense representing the United States? Anything else on that? I think it's a nil mention. We used to talk about products, we used to say how awful Exchange was, well, I've done that, and what the problems were with various things. Are there any products that are really changing the world there? I'm not aware of them. Right. And this is rambling around, but we'll come back to the ASRP before too long. Sender verification. How am I doing? We're going to run out of time on this. Those three things there, I forget. I hope I can say what they are. That's sender permitted from is SPF. These are all things that go in the DNS. They're not quite the same as the DNS blacklisting technology, but they're more like MX records essentially, sort of reverse MX. And that's what the third one means. It's reverse MX records. So instead of consulting the DNS before you send something, you get something that claims to be from where the originator address is in a particular domain, and you look up the domain to get some reverse MXs, which are the IP addresses from which mail for that domain is allowed to come. And because the information is controlled by the people who own the domain, you know, this is fairly resistant to tampering by spammers. Fairly. I've forgotten what DNP is. I've got the Reno. The ASRG are working on all this stuff because they like this sort of technology base. Sender pays we've said a bit about, both in real money, which I think is an idea which in its details is new to Microsoft, but also in CPU cycles, which is not. That's hash cash and camera. Filtering, I don't think there's anything wonderfully new in filtering. You know, in the past year, people have come up with Bayesian filtering, which are much more adaptive, and you know, Spam Assassin does quite well now, if you spend time tuning it. It doesn't, if Mally is still listening, it doesn't work at all well back in Gannett's cert, I'm afraid, where they're still tinkering and trying to get things just right there. But it's a hard case there. One of the issues we have is that people report spam to us, and for a filter to distinguish between spam and a report of spam is quite tricky. Anything else? Okay, well, marketers, you know, just worth pointing out that there's a whole lot of people doing this, and you have to think about it. I haven't actually read the message, but I think I get to talk to the UK DMA sometime, and that would be interesting to see what they. And I think what all DMA that I've ever seen before, they all say, we hate spam. Spam is what other people do. Our people don't do this. And you know, the conversation is somewhat complete. Bulk mailers rather the same, except that they're slightly different depending on it. Other ISPs, we're here to talk about that. RIRs, we haven't actually got. Is there anybody from AP here? Harry, hopefully I'm recognised by those places. but they, you know, we see those people here. I haven't got anything to add to that. ASRB, I'll talk to you in a minute. All right, okay, so any other groups of people? I haven't got a lot of sort of red hot content in here, but people should be aware that there's an anti-spam research group under the IRTF. There's a chair, actually two chairs now, there's a co-chair, John Levine. Some of you will know of John Levine, Internet for Dummies, and much good anti-spam work. Sorry, I forgot to put in the names. They've been much ridiculed as just being a talking shop where all the people who had a research project brought it along and said this is the way to do it, and they're all wrong. So they've actually set back a bit and tried to do things. Their website is been interesting. You'll see, I'll show you in a minute, straight away. Second one from the bottom, that says asrg.sp.am. Sorry, I should have found a better way of doing that. Right, so, and they've certainly split themselves into subgroups, and they're looking for volunteers. You have to look at their pages. Their next outing is to Seoul, when it comes up. These are the subgroups they've got. Abuse reporting, BCP, pilfering, inventory of problems. They've made some, it's rather abstract that, but they are doing some stuff on it. They're worried about the current email architecture. They're looking for an opportunity to say this SMTP is all over, we're going to do it properly now. I will not mention X400. They're talking about message verification, which is implied in some of the technologies you've been hearing about. And it's different from session verification, which at one level is what DNS VLs that Sabri was talking about. You know, will you accept the connection? It is a kind of session verification. So they've got these subgroups doing things. The details don't matter, I think. Does anybody want to ask anything? Okay. Database working group. We've introduced that, so I'm just going to skip over it for a moment. I wasn't at this at the year of yesterday, but those are the three things I picked out of the introductory text that Patrick Bellstrom left for us, and from his wonderful diagram. Who was there at the year of yesterday? Loads of people. Did anybody understand that diagram? Really? All right. All right. Oh, that's good. Oh, so it comes in bits, is it? Fine. Okay. In that case, I withdraw my scurrilous complaint about it. For those who haven't seen it, I'll try and show you at the end. He's actually tried to do what I said there, to identify paths that are important in SMTP mail, and pick out a collection of those where you can do some effective blocking. And that's interesting. And then he goes on to bang some drum he has about not blocking outbound port 25. And you can see why he would want to say that. It's an issue for people who are roaming around the place. You know, you'd actually like to be able to make direct connections from wherever they are without having to, you know, fiddle with their mail appointment to say. Submission port, it would be an idea. Did Patrick say anything on that? But does that fix the problem? Oh. Because you can, how does it fix it? What? If you can do what you want with, sorry, somebody? Okay, so this is the submission port 587 with some kind of local authentication flow. Okay. And this, that he regards as manageable for somebody who's just travelling around and dropping into life and dropping in somewhere else. Not clear to me how you did that. Okay, good. Well, so, I mean, sorry, I wasn't there. Is there anything else that could, well, I suggest you look at stuff, especially if you can get the building up thing. All I got was a PDF at the end of it, which is totally indigestible. It's all accurate, it's just not very digestible. Right, let's go back. I think we've got 5 minutes. I would like to, that's the thing I'd like to talk about. So I think I will come back to that, having just skipped over other stuff. Documents, that's exactly the same as last time. Nobody's done anything about those. somebody ought to, I ought to. If the days were longer, I would heat people up to rewrite some documents now. I think, with the exception of the abuse scene stuff, I don't think there's any other business that people have already mentioned that hasn't come up somewhere. Okay. This is an interesting one. Should this be a working group that covers abuse rather than just spam? Or email abuse or something? Or should there be a different working group? You don't have to answer that this question just here and now, but possibly it should be addressed somewhere. And whether it should be a security working group, and you know, the IRT people have their way, or through mail, which is the biggest kind of abuse, I don't know. Sorry. For next time, anybody who wants to offer a tutorial, it doesn't have to be Sabri, but somebody could, on anything that they think is relevant, you know, that people are banging on about or that they have the world's leading idea on, that'd be good. I'm rushing. We've sometimes had two sessions. Does anybody have a view that we should have two sessions in this working group? Double one? I think we've had two serious tutorials. We probably have two sessions. Yes, okay. Any other thoughts? Right. Wilfred, yes. That's fair comment. And I have to say that this is the sort of thing that the working group chairs have to beat each other up about, either through email or personally at a lunch where food is grown and things like that. And I think that's probably a forum where we could check up on that. That's fair comment. Piece of the mic? Well, sorry, I thought I was doing it. Oh, this is to Wilfred. Okay. Wilfred, he said, tutorials all very well, but if they're of any general application, they should probably come up in EOF rather than just as working group. The one that I keep thinking we should do, because people in this room may not ask for it, but other people do, is what to do with mail headers. You know, how do you read message headers and tell a story from it? It's obvious to some people, and it's completely opaque to others, some of whom should be able to do better. Some of my colleagues, for instance. Since you're writing to Mally. Okay. Right, now back on this abuse CSC. Wilfred has sort of given a good skate over what the issues are from the database working group's point of view, and also I think made the correct concession to the rest of the world who just want to type who is, and they want the right thing to come up. That's a fair summary, isn't it, really? And it doesn't happen with the right database for all the reasons he's mentioned. Even if we agree what the right thing was, it certainly doesn't come up first. It doesn't always happen with Aaron, because they've gone for these org abuse or whatever it's called things, which are a bit patchy and not, I think, quite uniformly provided. But if they're there, they're fairly easy to find. I think you have to say that. A PNIC have done neither of those things exactly, have they? I haven't checked that recently. Anyway, there are various ways you could do it. If there is a requirement to make an abuse contact come up fairly smartly, then that needs writing down, and we have to think of some way of doing it. And if it can be some way that is not completely unacceptable to Aaron in particular, then that would be better. There is a thought from the floor.
Yeah, this is a long shot. We're not talking about introducing abuse contacts in RightDB and OIDB. mentioned, like Aaron uses different screen. Joint effort to not include this in the RYBB or in the Aaron database whatsoever, but start off a new registry which just handles the abuse contact and might be mirroring that on Aaron and RYBB.
Okay, good thought. Any sort of details of how, who or how that might be?
Just a long shot, you might think of it as a suggestion instead of everything doing this own way, go for a joint effort.
I think the thing, there is a thing called abuse.net. Does everybody know about abuse.net? That is for domains, yes, because they found it useful. What, if you can get from whatever it is that causes you trouble to a domain, then that is actually quite useful. But fundamentally, we usually start with IP addresses, and the great thing about the Whois database is that they're a place where already you go from IP address to something. So that's why people think of it as the Whois registry.
Yeah, but like Wilfried suggested, there's the registry for registering IP addresses. It's also incorporating the routing registry, which is completely something different. Yeah. It might just include some form of a abuse registry.
Yeah. I don't know if other people will. Neil, you're going to say something. Let's have.
Yeah, thanks, Rodney. I hope I'm close enough to the microphone for all the people. It seems to me that there are really two ways we can approach this this issue. One is we identify a new piece of machinery to address it and try to sell that piece of machinery in two directions. In one direction, to the people who administer the network so that they know how to advertise their contacts correctly, which not all of them do, and mea culpa also. The second direction that it has to be sold in, of course, is towards the people who write these wonderfully nifty tools for notifying the appropriate person and use the wrong field. So we can invent a new piece of machinery to do that, or we can try to piggyback on the existing machinery. Now, the disadvantage of inventing yet another piece of, you know, an extra pair of cogs to mesh in the gearbox is that this involves committing resources from the regional internet registries in advance of any credible demonstration that there might be a payback. And I know what I'd say to that kind of proposal coming from this working group if I were in Wilfried's shoes in the database working group. But I think I know also how the general manager or managing director of a regional internet registry would react to a claim on his resources from a community that has failed at least once to do the advertising correctly. So, not through any serious, not through a lack of good intentions and trying to go about it the right way, but just it hasn't got the right people listening, and it's not clear that it's going to get the right people listening for the new piece of mechanism. And that leads me to the conclusion, and I offer this privately and I mean, on my own responsibility, I don't expect everybody to agree with me. It'd be nice if they did. But it leads me to the conclusion that the proper way to do this is to piggyback it on existing mechanisms. And one way to do this, for example, would be to put in the email attribute of the person or role object a what we might call a hint or a comment or a phrase. It's easier perhaps if I could plug this in because I have a nice
who knows, it might work.
Not too important.
This is like the Vodafone ad about the plug it in and then open it up.
Yeah.
and whatever else it might be.
That's good.
Well, it seemed okay at the time. Yeah. Have you got to press some of these switching things? This time? Hang on, we've got a. No, you've got an authentic. Okay. That's more like it.
This one, I guess. I think I've covered the which approach thing. Probably it's well to say something about the process. Because whichever way we go, we need a recommendation from out of this working group, and if we go looking for new machinery, it goes to whatever working group is responsible for vetting the requests for that machinery. And then if we, I think I've made the distinction between, or I've made the argument about whether we should go for a new attribute or a new piece of machinery or overload something that exists already. But how to do the overloading? I'm sorry. The screen size of this screen is smaller than the screen size that this one believes it to be, so you don't quite see everything as neatly as I planned. But we can fairly easily publish the hints on the email attribute by adding an 822 comment or prepending an 822 phrase and putting the real address inside angle brackets, or even by putting a comment in the trailing end of the line that's really a database comment rather than a something that gets used, something that gets incorporated in the to address of the email. And then all we have to do if we go down this road is to draw up the documents that say we believe we should do this, which is at the moment is still an open question, and we then need a document which tells network administrators what are the recommended hint strings to use to advertise the different preferences for the different mailboxes. And the same document or an associated document would then be targeted also at the people who make the scripts that do the work.
Yeah, this sort of is already there. If you dig to the database dump, there are currently around 103,000 InetNum objects, which include these kind of hints in the remarks attribute. The big problem is that it's freeform.
What is freeform?
The suggested solution here is to put in hints, which people now tend to use the remarks attribute for. And a recent count showed 103,000 remark attributes containing a line of use attribute. It sort of doesn't work because it's free form. I believe it's hard to automate for people writing simple complaining utilities to parse the free form strings, and whatever you do, you can recommend a lot, like put in a hash mark abuse or something, but as long as it's not a standard or some kind of best current practice.
I have a bad feeling about this, that it's actually overloading a comment field, essentially. I mean, it's not always.
That's what we are doing already, yeah. Like 103,000 abuse addresses or remarks, it's kind of overloaded.
Okay. Wilfred, you were gonna say something different, or?
Yeah,
sorry, we are over time. If you've got to go, you've got to go. It's perhaps my fault. We got to this a bit late. I shall stay here until everybody stops talking.
I'd like to follow up on that because my point of view here is that as soon as you change the schema of the object, sort of the definition of what the attributes would look like, you have to modify each and every piece of software which reads an answer from the Whois server anyway, because it's a new thing. So my personal point of view, that's not wearing the working group hat, it's just wearing my internet user's hat. My point of view here is that it's much more important to actually work on the definition of complaint categories or incident categories or whatever you call that in the end, and try to agree on a reasonably very small set of catchphrases or words or tags or ASCII strings. It could be A1 to A5, it could be spam, law violation, child porn, whatever. I really don't mind what the character set in the string is. I think the most important thing here is that we can come up with 2, maybe 3, maybe 4, maybe 5 categories. And one of those would probably be spam. There would probably be another thing like DDoS or whatever, or copyright violation, whatever it is in the end. And my point here is, wherever you put that particular string is of secondary importance, at least initially. The more important thing is to develop sort of a common understanding what the categories are for the user's end and for the receiving end, and then put that somewhere. And I really don't mind where it's going to go, where it's going to go into the name of an attribute, sort of into the comment of an RFC 822 address, or at the end of the line. Because what I'm hearing from other camps dealing not primarily with spam is that they want to see some infrastructure in place which allows the user community at large, sort of the consumers of answers from the database, to pre-select where they send their complaints to. Because this is it's their belief that this has a better chance to scale than having just one entry point for all the different types of complaints for an organization, and then expecting that organization internally sort of to sort them into the different bins, like this is the thing which goes to the law department, this is the thing which goes to the techies, which have to fend off a denial of service attack within 5 or 10 minutes.
So this would be a sort of rewrite of RFC 2142?
Maybe.
Right.
And this is actually the reason why I'm here in this working group today, which I usually am not because of these collisions, because I'd really like to collect that feedback, or to invite you also to come to the database working group tomorrow and sort of try to develop an understanding what the user communities are, what their needs are, and sort of what you expect the other side to do with that complaint flood. Because as was said on more than one occasion here, just offering them another RFC address to send their complaints to is just, for some abuse teams or incident response teams or user help desk functions or whatever, just another chance to double quote spam second order them. And they would probably, as we had these discussions then, well, then you have to make sure that something is actually reading it and reacting to it. What are you going to do? You put up a Perl script which gets you the answer, thank you for submitting this complaint and we are going to deal with it according to our AUP. Or they would point the mailbox to /dev/null or whatever the technical solution is. It doesn't get you anywhere in the end. That's my private point of view here.
Can I just add to what Bobby said, that there is, he's correct, you know, a lot of what he says is right, but there's also a sort of body of existing use, and we've actually got people doing things at the moment and getting frustrated with it, which I think were not one of the categories you mentioned. I mean, they have found all this stuff out there in Whois and loads of other places, and they have, in some cases successfully, in some cases not so successfully, they've decided this is how they're going to use it. And we have to at least take them into account as well. They're taking into account. More?
Well, your suggestion on RFC 2142, I think the main issue here is that maybe we need some form to incorporate standards the RFC says, like create and abuse mailbox for the domains and or subdomains, to incorporate that into the IP registry. I think that was also kind of Wilfried's point.
I think
make sure that there's a standard and now everybody is doing something and they're,
those are consistent so far, yes. Anything else? Wilfred has asked, Wilfred has asked that anybody who's mildly interested in this goes along to the database working group tomorrow. I should be there, and that's a good idea.
And It's from IRC. There was a long discussion just about the thing.
Sorry, I interrupted. From Hong Kong?
I just got a response from Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, sorry. Yes, yes. Have you? Right. Should we have a party? That's right. Yeah. Okay, so all is not lost. Ofcom have replied to a letter. That's good. Mind you, I got a reply from them, and they just said, no, we don't do this. Okay. Abuse C. Nobody questions that this is a problem. Nobody's come up with the single answer. Wilfred's comment is that we have no business coming up with a single answer today, because we should make sure we take it quite widely. I hope that's not misrepresenting you. Anything else to say about that? In that case, I think we're well into injury time, and we should all go and listen to the organ. Thank you very much for coming. Is there anybody still here who didn't write on the sheet?
Sell you one of those.
Well done. Thank you for all your tolerance and for watching us all make a shambles of the kit. There's obviously something wrong with the switch. We've got the tension up there. Fine, if it's only mild, it is. Just try and find some other things. What's going on? Why is that not showing? Did I turn off the
laser? Oh, it doesn't matter. I don't think it needs broken.
I didn't remember turning it off. Yeah, do. Thank you. Yeah, I'll talk about it.
No, I know what you're saying. You don't know the details of where we can get this.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. Thank you.
Sorry, you've got no signal for me.
No,
we have
a broken cable.
Oh, really? Is a broken cable? No wonder we can make it work. Okay. Sorry about that. Chris Nepolsky. Oh, right, right. It's not broken because it hasn't got a cover, is it? There's always one that hasn't got a cover. Okay, the box, okay. Yeah, right. Oh, there you are.